Hey guys, welcome into another episode of From the Wing. I'm Christian Clark, the Pelicans beat writer for NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune. Got a special guest today. We're going to talk playoffs. We're going to talk Pelicans offseason. And we're going to talk about the best television show going right now, Succession. Here with my guy, Will Giller. How you doing, man?
I'm good, man. The Disgusting Brothers. We're back, man. On a mother effing tour, man. Let's do it.
Disgusting Brothers. Why is that show so funny?
God, I don't know, man. Because it's like I usually don't go for these type of shows. But, God, I just crack up laughing every 2 seconds watching Succession. It is incredible. And we've talked about this before. They are so good at making you laugh, but also making you feel like your heart's racing a mile a minute, like every other scene. It's incredible the way they go back and forth. But, yeah, we'll get more into it later.
Yeah, I've got that saved for the end. I have a lot of thoughts, and then a question I want to ask you about maybe the succession that went on in New Orleans in the last 10 years and things like that. But you've been covering the Miami Heat so far. You got to do a couple of their games when they upset Milwaukee in the first round. You've been on their second round series against the Knicks. The Heat are one win away from making the Eastern Conference Finals if they can get that last win. They'll be the first 8 seed since the Knicks in 1999 to advance to a conference finals. How the heck are they doing this? They were almost dead. The Chicago Bulls, the sad Chicago Bulls, almost killed them in the play-in tournament.
It's really wild, man. They were down at home with 3 minutes left in the play-in game where if they lost, the season's over. And now they're one win away from the conference finals. And what's crazy is like they kind of cruised, right? I mean, they beat the Bucks in 5. They could possibly beat the Knicks in 5 or 6 here. It's really crazy. I think it's a testament to being around that team. Of course, Jimmy Butler's amazing playoff. Jimmy, he's just so comfortable in his role as kind of the star of a team and the star of, a playoff, basketball and just understanding how to adjust. But I think that the two people I've really been impressed by just being around the Heat is Eric Spoelstra and just his grasp of the moment, grasp of his team, how to adjust, how to, kind of fit around the personalities on his team. Because Jimmy Butler is a wild boy. he's tough to deal with at times. And I think Spoelstra maybe, I would say not even maybe, definitely more than any other coach Jimmy has been around, just understands Jimmy, how to bring the best out of him, how to work with him, how to talk with him. And I think the partnership they have, it's truly amazing. And it wasn't that long ago. Those two were looking like they were ready to wring each other's neck on the bench, right? Or they had to be separated. What was that, maybe last year or 2 years ago? And I think Spoelstra has done a phenomenal job just understanding how to bring the best out of Jimmy and everybody else on that team. And the other guy is just Bam Adebayo. Like, I thought Bam was great before I got to go see them in Miami. But just seeing them up close, I think his versatility as a center is just so rare. And it's not just, what he does offensively and being able to get you, 30 on a certain night, 15 rebounds. He had a damn near triple-double when they closed out the Bucks. But his ability defensively to just play every single coverage. We talk about this a lot with the Pelicans where JV does a lot of great things for the Pelicans, but they kind of feel hesitant with him late in games because he can only play one defensive coverage, right? It's drop coverage. You know what is coming when JV's out there. And with Bam, you can play drop. You can bring him up high and hedge the screen. You can trap. You can play zone. He does whatever you need. You can switch him out on a little guy, and he moves his feet. I think he's so good at every facet of the game, and it gives them so much versatility in what they do on both ends of the court. This team is really impressive, and what's been great about them, and I wrote this after Game 4, is they just adapt. It's not like they're going out saying, we need to do this to succeed. They just kind of figure it out as they go. And they say, okay, we need to get offensive rebounds tonight. We'll do that. We need to hit threes. We'll do that. Jimmy, we need you to get 50. He can do that. And I think so many teams in their shoes are kind of incapable. And you see with the Knicks where they get brought out of their comfort zone and it's like, oh God, I don't know what to do now. We can't play how we've been playing all year. Now we're lost. And with the Heat, they just see what the game demands of them and they go do it. And I think it's been extremely impressive to watch them.
Yeah, I mean, kind of one of my takeaways from this playoff so far is, in a lot of respects, this is, a guards league, I think, but bigs are still extremely important. I mean, if you look at the teams that are probably going to be the last four standing, you know, none of this is set in stone right now, but just the way it's looking right now, LA and Denver in the West, and then Philadelphia and Miami in the East. I mean, I think three best bigs in the game are part of those teams, and Jokic, Embiid, and AD. I don't know. You can put them in some separate order, but to me, those are the top three guys. And then, I don't know, Bam's probably got a strong case as number four, you know, just because of the defensive versatility and all he brings. But yeah, it's still really valuable to have a very good big on your team. I mean, you need them to go deep in the playoffs, I think.
No doubt. And I think, just like I brought up before, it's about having bigs who can do a little bit of everything and being able to adjust to whatever your opponent kind of brings to you. And I think we really underestimate Bam at times just because his offensive numbers don't always look great. He's comfortable going into a game and taking 5-6 shots or, you know, just kind of chilling out on the offensive end. But just the way they can kind of dial up whatever defense they need to play, is what really makes this team special. And you've seen, you know, the way they've kind of made life difficult for Jalen Brunson. They can put Jimmy on him. Gabe Vincent, I think, has done an incredible job defending Jalen Brunson. And with Bam, he's just holding off those New York Knicks bigs. That's where they kill teams all year, pounded them on the offensive glass. And Bam, at times he's been guarding Julius Randle one-on-one. At times he's been fighting with Mitchell Robinson to keep him off the offensive glass. He just does so much for that team. And I've heard Spoelstra talk multiple times in his press conference, and he said, you know, it's hard to really, you know, assess how much Bam impacts the game just by the box score. You got to really see just the effort he brings every single night. It's a game changer for that team. And I think you're exactly right. We kind of focus on the guards and these guys who are putting up big numbers. But it's hard to win in this league unless you can put at least one or two bigs out there that can really impact the game in multiple ways. And I think it's something that the Pels are going to have to think about moving forward. Because you said it, we see the Final Four, the way it's shaping out. They've got the best bigs in the league. And it's crazy to say when we've talked for the last few years about everybody going smaller. Everybody in the league's got to play faster. You got to shoot more. And to win, you know, when it comes down to these bigger games, it always comes down to, can you defend that area right in front of the rim? Can you rebound? And I think that's what these four teams have done at a high level.
Yeah, I mean, I read your mailbag that you just posted recently. And, you know, I think, you know, my thoughts on your takeaways was, hey, look, a lot of the major pieces, like there's a lot of talent here. Let's change some things around the margin, but it is not time to blow it up or anything like that yet. And I think, you know, with a little time to reflect, like I'm in the same boat. Like, I think at the end of the season, I was like so pissed the way it went. I was like, ah, you know, like maybe you look at blowing it up. This was ridiculous. But you know, like as you said in your mailbag, like, Zion's going into year one of a 5-year extension. And as frustrating as it's been, like I kind of agree with you. Like, do you explore trading Zion Williamson? Hell no. I agree with you completely. I mean, he's just too good, and we're too early into this, I think, to part ways with him. And I kind of feel like that with Brandon too, as frustrating as these last 2 years have been, and you know, him kind of dealing with some of unavailability stuff. It's like, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, been extremely frustrating not to see these guys on the court at the same time and them playing, you know, 10 games together the last 2 years. But I feel like you just kind of got to keep swinging the bat and hope for some injury luck and some other things to go your way. And just, you have to at least try one more time to see what you have in those two guys together, I feel like.
Yeah. And I think just because these guys have been together for 4 years now, we kind of forget that they're still very young, right? I think, especially with Zion, you know, he still hasn't even played 150 games in the league, which is crazy to say. It feels like Herb's played 150 games in like a year and a half during his first 2 years in the league. And he's still, with Zion, we've seen so much greatness in him and so many historic numbers. We can bring up all the crazy stuff he's done, but he's still just getting started. And I think we could have conversations about what he can do to put himself in a better position to play more games. I think that's something that, you know, I think it was, you know, a pleasant surprise to see Griff kind of say that, you know, openly in his end of season press conference, like, hey, we need to do some better stuff, but he's got to do some better stuff too. He's got to be more mindful of what he's doing to make sure he's ready. And I think the same goes for B.I., the same goes for basically everybody on his team, because almost everybody on his team, except for JV and maybe a few other guys has missed time over the past few years. I think they really got to focus on just keeping everybody on the court. And I do think this is the last year where the patience kind of is still there. I think this is going to be, I think we thought that last summer, like this is the year where everything's got to come together now. But I think after seeing the way last season went, if they got another year where, you know, these guys are playing 30, 40 games, I think you got to start asking some serious questions about the way this thing is built. But you mentioned it, man. I think that's what Griff kind of wanted to do last summer, was to lock all of these guys in contractually where it's not this big concern about what the future is. So I think they got Zion and B.I. under contract moving forward. They got CJ, Larry, Nance, Dyson, Herb, Trey Murphy. All of these guys are locked in. And I think having that kind of gives you the comfort of saying, okay, even if things haven't worked out, we can bring our core back together. We know what this thing is going to look like moving forward. We just got to figure out how to fix what hasn't worked so far. And I think it's just very frustrating because I think it's much easier to say, okay, we're not shooting the ball well. We can go get shooters. We're not defending well. We can go get some defensive-minded guys. But when the concern is everybody's hurt, and there's not a simple solution, right? It's not like, well, guys just need to stop spraining their ankles. Guys need to stop stubbing their toes. I think it's not easy to answer injury questions. But I think, like you said, the best thing you really can do, and it's not satisfying all the time for fans, is to just say, you got to just hope for the best. You know, that's the only thing you really can do when it comes to some of these injuries. And obviously, I think in particular, some of that is things he can control and being in better condition and being just more mindful of the way you're handling things when you're away from the court. But some of this is just like, man, Larry Nance just can't land on somebody's ankle at the end of the year. You know, it's some of that you just can't control, and it's some of that you just got to hope for better luck moving forward.
And you brought it up. I thought it was interesting at the exit interviews. I mean, there were a handful of players basically saying, hey, look, Zion's just got to be a little bit better in terms of his preparation off the court. We kind of heard that from CJ, you know, Larry, G Temp, like a lot of the respected veterans on this team. And we heard that from Griff too. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but he basically said, you know, quite frankly, a lot of this is on him too. And that was, I think, one of the first times, and this year was, you know, maybe the first time I've heard Griff say on the record in front of all the cameras, like, look, there are things we can be doing better, of course, but like, he has just got to improve in his preparation and becoming a better professional. And I actually think that is the right approach. Like, I just think like playing games is not the way that you make progress in this situation. I just think being matter of fact about it, as Griff was at the end, you know, maybe there is like a little frustration initially, but like, I just think you keep doing that and just say, yeah, like we're not perfect. We definitely can get better, but like he's got to get better too. And just being as honest as you can about the situation in front of all the cameras. And if they're so mad that they want to trade, okay. Like you're going to ask for a trade in year one of a 5-year extension when you've played 114 games in 4 years, it's like, do it, you know? And like, we'll get some guys who like want to be here and do the right things. But like, it's just, to me, I think putting the onus on him a little bit is actually a positive thing.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting, Griff, during that press conference, he kept on referring to Zion as the kid, right? The kid. And he called himself and said, I got to stop calling him a kid. And in my mind, I was like, exactly right. I mean, this guy next year is going to be making $30 million. We can't keep talking about Zion as a young player, as a guy who's learning. He's a max player now. He's making max money. He's making face of the franchise money. So you got to start moving that way. You got to start performing that way. You got to, you know, be present in the way that, you know, max face of the franchise guys are. And I think that's what the conversation has to be around Zion now, not just with us, but with those guys, with the Pelicans, with Griff, with Brandon Ingram, with CJ McCollum. When they talk publicly, it's not about Zion being a kid anymore, because he's not. He's been around. He's been in this league for a pretty good time now. He's on his second contract now. So he's got to start being held to that standard. And people's got to start talking about him that way. And I think you're exactly right. It kind of, a lot of the times, just being around this team, I don't know if you agree, a lot of the times it's felt like the Pelicans with B.I., with CJ, with this ideal that Griffith's kind of put forward since the day he came in, and then Zion just kind of been over here on his own. And it's kind of felt like he's been separate from what they're doing and what they're building. And it's kind of like, yeah, we got everything we wanted. This is exactly what we wanted to look like. And then Z's just kind of over here, the super talented guy, and he's figuring it out. And I think they've been trying to figure out ways to kind of mesh that and make him more of what they want and what they kind of see as the ideal build here in New Orleans. But of course, there's been, you know, tension on both sides. There's been injuries. Of course, it's tough when a guy's injured for long periods of time to have him feel like he's part of the team. We had that conversation a lot in year three with Zion, where he's not playing, so it's hard for him to feel like part of the team. Once he goes to Portland, it's even more difficult for him to feel like part of the team. But I think, like I said, those days got to be over, man. He's got to be in the trenches with these guys. He's got to show that he's willing to do whatever to put the injuries behind him to be a leader for this team. Because, again, you're making max money now, man. It's not about you being a young player anymore. You got to lead this group, because it's not just about, you know, me saying how much money he is or me checking his pockets. I'm never that guy. But when you're making that much money, that means it's more difficult to keep these other guys around, right? So now the construction of this roster is going to change moving forward, because you're paying your best three players $90 million a year. That's just the reality for this team moving forward. So when you're doing that, that puts more onus on those guys to produce, to be those guys. So you don't need Josh Richardson to contribute big time and make $12 million off your bench. You don't need all of these other pieces to lift you up, because you have these $30 million players. That's what they're supposed to do. That's why they're making that much money. And I think now more than ever, Zion has to be that guy, because it's going to be more difficult moving forward for them to put the pieces around these guys, because you're paying your best players a whole lot of money to put this roster together. And I think the stress is going to be higher than ever for those guys to show up and be there and produce, because it's going to be difficult to put the pieces around them to lift them up when they're not there.
As Larry Nance Jr. said, heavy is the head that wears the crown. I mean, yeah, it is, you know, you get a lot of great stuff being a guy with that high profile and that kind of contract, but there's a ton of pressure. I mean, you could just see it on some of these guys in the playoffs. Like I've heard a lot of the Nuggets role players talk about, like, I feel like Jokic is dealing with the weight of the world. Like, he knows basically if they don't make it to the finals, like, he's going to get crushed, and some of that will be deserved. And I don't know, maybe some of it won't be, but like, there is a lot of pressure on those guys, and understandably so. Are you ready to live in a world where Trey Murphy's maybe $100 million player? I mean, he's got one more year before, you know, he's eligible to negotiate extension, but you know, if he has a year next year like he did last year, I think it might be a lucrative contract for Mr. Murphy.
Listen, man, that dude shoots 40% from three and 60% from two. Those guys get paid in this league, you know. Those guys make a lot of money, and I think there's no question that he's going to make a whole lot of money to do what he does, and they need him. And I think he's on the verge of becoming, you know, an incredible role player. And I don't think he would want me to hear me say that, because I think Trey definitely looks at himself as more than just a role player. We know that guy has high belief in himself and what he can do. But, yeah, I mean, them hitting on that Trey Murphy pick was massive. And we can talk a lot about the mistakes that Griff and the front office have made. But hitting on that Trey Murphy pick, hitting on the Herb Jones pick, landing Jose Alvarado, it was a franchise changer for this team. There's no question. And those guys are going to be huge for this team moving forward. Because, again, when you're paying CJ, BI, and Zion, the amount of money you're paying those guys, it's going to be difficult to put the role players around them. And it's going to help to have all of these future first-round picks. But you need the Trey Murphys and the Herb Jones of the world to really step up and be big time, because those are going to be the assets that really surround Zion and BI moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in the New Orleans market, you have to win on the margins. Like, you have to, you know, have some triples or home runs when you have the 17th pick. And every now and then, again, you got to hit on a guy in the second round like they did with Herb, and then, you know, get some production out of undrafted guys like Jose and Najee. I mean, that draft class was really the turning point, you know, assuming they continue to move forward of all of this for me, because those first 2 years.
And just think about Memphis traded down from 10 – or Pelicans traded down, I should say, from 10 to 17. Memphis trades up to go get Zaire Williams. Zaire Williams couldn't even play for Memphis in the playoffs. I mean, Imagine if Trey Murphy is that guy at 10, what he could have did for the Memphis Grizzlies and spacing the floor and making it a little easier for the Grizzlies. And that's another team, like you said, when you're a smaller market, you got to hit on the margins. I'm sure they would love to have that pick back and have a guy who can contribute right now the way Trey Murphy did for this team. So I think, again, it's about making the right type of moves. And that's I think that goes down as no doubt as a home run, especially when you factor in getting JV out of that deal. And that's one where if you take Zaire instead of Trey Murphy, this team is in a whole different position right now, right? We're talking about this roster in a much different way. So, yeah, I think it's extremely important to hit on those picks to make the right moves, because we saw with Memphis, if you don't, then that's going to put you in a very tough position when you play in these big games. And now you're making tough decisions like, what do we do with Dylan Brooks? What do we do with all of these other guys? Because we need to fix the problem that we've created for ourselves by taking Zaire Williams with the 10th overall pick.
Yeah, totally. And I remember people on the Pelicans saying before that draft, you know, part of their calculus was, we feel like there's some like really talented guys who are going to be available in the middle of the first round. We don't feel like we have to be up at 10. And they were right. Like they totally nailed that one. Their intel was correct that none of the teams in front of them when they went back to 17 would take Trey Murphy. And I think they really liked them. And I think, you know, Bryson Graham was one of the driving forces behind that pick. And that was some great work there. But yeah, that was kind of the turning point.
I think they really liked Franz too. And once they realized Franz wasn't going to be there at 10, they were more willing to move back as well.
I'm a big Franz Wagner guy.
Oh, I love
it. It's going to shock
Franz.
You, I know.
Love me some Franz for sure.
Oh, man. Let's talk about the Lakers a little bit. You know, it's looking like it's going to be a Lakers Nuggets Western Conference Finals. The Lakers looked dead early in the season. I mean, I was dancing on their graves when they were 0-5.
We all were. We all
were. This sucks, man. This really sucks. I have to give credit to Rob Pelinka. I mean, like, this, I don't know how he undid those mistakes. You know, they're kind of doing this with defense. You know, they're leading the playoffs in defensive rating right now. They're like 2 points better than the next closest team. To me, Anthony Davis has been the best defensive player in the NBA in the playoffs. I mean, what have you just seen from them as a team and how they've, you know, kind of righted the ship?
Yeah, I mean, AD has been incredible. And I think, you know, obviously he's gotten a lot of criticism for his up and down performance on the offensive end, just the way his numbers and his shooting percentages have been really inconsistent and, you know, deservedly so. But I think defensively he's been a rock for that team, and he's made life so difficult for a Golden State team where we're so used to them kind of figuring it out as a series goes, right? How that we're going to attack you, how we're going to put Steph and Clay in the right positions. And they just keep making adjustments, and they keep coming back to, we don't know what to do with AD. We don't know how to get around this guy, how to get to the basket, how to prevent him from making such a huge impact. And I think he just deserves a lot of credit for what he's done defensively and just his IQ, because we talk a lot about his long arms and his athleticism and the way he can move his feet. But I think the way he sees the game, the way he knows how to put his body in the right positions to not get in foul trouble, I think he's been sensational, what he's doing defensively, and he's changed that entire team. And I think he's also finally embracing playing the center position, which is something that we didn't see a whole lot here in New Orleans, which is frustrating for some people, I know.
Was it?
Some people who were on that team who are looking at him now like, man, I wish I had this AD back then. I think he deserves credit for what he's done. And I think, you know, what's crazy watching him early in the season, we used to say a lot like, man, they're playing Russell, they're playing Pat Beverly, Austin Reeves. They're so tiny. They don't defend. You can kind of bully them. And now they're out there with LeBron, AD, Rui Hachimura. They're so big and they're so stout, and you got to play up just to keep them from kind of pushing you around. And I think, you know, they deserve a lot of credit for the way they've rebuilt that roster. Jared Vanderbilt's another guy. You got to play up to kind of prevent him from just beating you up on the offensive boards. And, man, they just hit a grand slam with that Russell Westbrook trade, landing Vanderbilt, Beasley, and D'Lo. D'Lo's a guy who was criticized in that deal. Even during the first round of the playoffs, people were saying, man, you could have had Mike Conley instead of D'Lo. Why would you make that deal? And then now D'Lo's having these huge offensive games, and it's kind of, you know, covered up what is kind of one of the worst kept secrets during these playoffs, is that LeBron really hasn't played at that high of a level
No.
the way we expect from him during the playoffs. He really hasn't been that guy. Of course, he's been good. He's made his plays in transition. He's been good defensively. But we're not seeing the 35-11-11 LeBron we've seen in the past, especially against the Warriors. And a big reason they've been able to get away with that is because of D'Lo's putting up good offensive numbers. Rui Hachimura is hitting threes. Austin Reeves has been able to attack the paint. And they've made a ton of these small – we talked about how small market teams have to make good moves on the margins. The Lakers don't have to do that, but they have. They landed Austin Reeves. They got D'Lo in that deal when it kind of felt like they could have just kept Mike Conley out of it. They've done a really great job finding role players to fit around LeBron. And, you know, one of the guys I loved going in that deal. We talked a lot. We both love us at Malik Beasley, and he can't get off the bench in this series. I feel like he can contribute. But like you said, they're really leaning in the defense and guys who can attack off the dribble. Dennis Schroeder is another guy. They got on the minimum contract playing big minutes for them. They deserve a lot of credit for the way they just built up that roster and going from, you know, the laughing stock of the league during the first few weeks of the year, starting out 2-10. We were over here looking at Wemby highlights, kind of rubbing our hands together like, oh, man, they're going to have the big 7-4 guy in New Orleans. And now they got a shot to go to the conference finals. It's really incredible.
Will, they still have a chance at Wemby, man. I don't know why you're writing it off.
What is it? 0.000001%, I think it is now.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. It's 7 zeros and then a one. And that's what it is. Yeah.
Listen, so you're saying there's a chance.
I know Griff is gonna be going on that stage like in his head, being like, we can win this. Like I know that's how he's gonna be too. Be like counting us out, you know, like, I mean, that's totally how he's going to be. He's going to be pissed when they don't win it.
Yeah, he's going to bring, what was the good luck charm from the Zion season that he brought it here from Cleveland? He's going to bring that out.
He's the tie. And then he had the wooden angel from the woman angel. In Metairie. Yeah. I believe her name is Connie Halfin. I would have to double check that. But yeah, she had a wooden angel she gave him.
Yeah, those were different times, man. Different times. Life was much more optimistic back then. I'll tell you that much.
Well, I mean, look, you know how the Griff Alvin thing went that one year they're together here. I mean, like when you look back and see them embracing after Zion, like, is it like, oh man, if I had known then what I know now, like, what would you be thinking?
I know, man. That moment literally happened right in front of me. I mean, Andrew Lopez was standing right there and watching. You know, David Griffin and Alvin Gentry embracing that moment. And it felt like, wow, this is a new era in New Orleans. Because remember, I always remind people, this wasn't just landing Zion. Of course, any team that landed Zion during that moment, it would have been massive. It was a franchise changer. But this was a team that just came off of the ugly saga with Anthony Davis. And I sat there in that arena during that season, and it was just horrible vibes every single night. Just people, I mean, Anthony Davis walking off, flicking the middle finger at fans and, you know, just terrible. There was talk about, is this team going to stay in New Orleans? You know, how are they going to be able to rebuild? And then you go from that to landing Zion Williamson. It was like, oh my God, it's a new day. And, you know, seeing the way things ended with Alvin Gentry and David Griffin. If you know those guys behind the scenes, it's probably not that surprising. But seeing that moment to what it became, it's like, yeah, it's pretty wild.
I'm just going to leave it on that. Leave it at that. We have to talk about a little bit about Succession before I let you go. For those that don't know, you know, it's in its last season. It's a show on HBO, and it is about this, you know, I guess like aging media titan, Logan Roy. And, you know, he's kind of deciding, well, who do I want to give the empire to? One of my three kids or somebody else, and spoiler, that is the crux of the show. And there are no likable characters. They're all just objectively terrible people.
I love the show. Debatable.
Do you have to be a sicko to like this show? Like, I'm just trying to understand why I like this show.
I definitely think you have to be a sicko to find some of the characters likable like I do. So, yeah, I mean, for me, you know how much I love me some Greg the Egg. So I think he's a likable character. I'm a Tom Wongans guy.
Me too.
He's a likable guy. I'm a con head as well. I think he's a very likable guy. So, yeah, I think you definitely have to be a sicko to love this show and to kind of get all the intricacies of all of these conversations and how everybody is making a move. And I think it's so fascinating that you kind of see these people at weddings or at funerals or these moments where it's like, you feel like, okay, we can kind of finally let our hair down and not feel like we're in the fire. And that's when the fire is hottest, right? That's when the biggest moves happen, when stuff isn't supposed to be happening. And I think with these people, they're just constantly finding ways to climb the ladder, to push somebody down, to spread a rumor, to gain some leverage. And I think it's a nice glimpse into just the way the business world works, especially at the highest level. And I think also Jesse Armstrong and what he was able to do with this series and just the crazy mind he has. And you mentioned it, this show is at its height, and it's so many people love this show and so many people are tuning in and tweeting out the quotes. And he's just like, you know what? This is my last season. I don't have any more left to tell with this story, and I'm done. And I think so many other people would have just saw the bag moving forward from this series and be like, I can just figure something out. Kendall can do something. We'll make one more season. He's just like, you know what? This is the story I want to tell, and I'm done now. And we're going to finish it here, and it is what it is. And I respect the hell out of it. That's not something I would have done, because I know there's a lot of dollar signs in front of him. but just from an artistic standpoint, I respect the hell out of what he's doing with this series.
I think one of the reasons I like the show is that, you know, after Trump and after January 6th, it feels so difficult to make art that is really good about kind of how America is now. And this feels like one of the best representations of, you know, how the 1% operate and how people in power, you know, are kind of unaffected, even though bad things are happening that affect like the masses, and just, you know, how it works at the top and kind of what this country is like now. And I don't know, I would say I'm a mostly optimistic person, but like a lot of it's been depressing, and they've really captured a lot of that. I mean, like, you know, I don't think this is spoiling that much, but like, you know, like these last few episodes of the show are going to be about an election where, you know, a right-wing cable news organization, you know, might have some impact there. And it's like, yeah, that is quite a mirror to what happened in the world pretty recently.
It's like I've been there before. Yeah. But no, I think, you know, it's even more than that with this series, right? Because we're talking about the election. We're talking about, like you said, the succession of this huge media empire and how you kind of handle, you know, the passing on from one leader to the next, and, you know, how, you know, the people are constantly fighting behind the scenes to put themselves in a position to be the next person. And, you know, we've kind of saw a little bit of that with Gail Benson. And once Tom Benson passed away, the fight between Gail Benson and Tom Benson's children, and, you know, how a lot of that spilled publicly and it got ugly. And, you know, it doesn't just happen with the Bensons. I think you see this with a lot of these huge media companies. And I think a lot of owners and professional sports, right? You see these guys who, you know, build themselves up into these huge businessmen and businesswomen who are able to make tons and tons of money. And eventually, like all of us, you know, they eventually pass away or they eventually move on, and you figure out how to move that business on to the next person. And I think what you see with this show, and what you see a lot of these guys, you look down at their kids and you say, man, you're not capable of running this thing the way that guy did. You don't have the business mind that this guy had. And I think it's very difficult when you grow up as a billionaire kid to kind of have the same hunger, to have the same, you know, ambition that, you know, these huge media or these huge business titans have, because you didn't have to have that hunger, right? You kind of had it when you were growing up. People were, you know, waiting on you from the moment you came out of the womb. So how could you have the same hunger as a Logan Roy? How could you develop the same type of negotiating chops when you didn't need to be that person? You didn't need to be that. You're kind of just Kendall Roy, and yeah, I'm the guy, and everybody bows when I walk into the room, and that's just what I expect. So, but also, it's understandable when people say, yeah, when you have those traits, you're not really built to lead. You don't have what it takes to take this thing to the next level or be able to handle really crises that come up when you're running the business. So yeah, I think it's very fascinating from that, especially as a sports, coming from a sports minded guy, to say, yeah, I think we see this a lot with these owners who come up or are able to buy these teams And when it's time to pass it on to the kids, it's like, oh God, they don't know what the hell they're doing. They don't know how to handle this in the correct way. And I think it's something that a lot of people who make that level of money, they really fight with themselves, because you want to build this future for your children and put them in a position to not have to struggle the way you did. But you also want this thing to be running the correct way to keep that legacy moving forward beyond just the one generation. And I think it's fascinating the way they've handled that, and the way you kind of see what all of these kids, they kind of have what it takes in certain pieces, but then you look back big picture and say, God, none of them, I wouldn't trust these people to run anything, let alone one of the biggest media companies in the world.
Well, yeah, I mean, Roman oversaw that rocket launch, and it didn't go well. The rocket exploded. It's so hard for me not to draw comparisons between the show and kind of, you know, what has happened in South Louisiana in the last 10 years. I mean, Tom Benson decided, no, my children, my grandchildren are not fit to run this empire. I am choosing my third wife, and I am choosing, you know, my Franks and my Jerrys to run this empire. That's who got the empire down here. You know, I think,
want to ask you who's the Frank and who's the Jerry on the Pelican stuff. We'll do that off camera, because we don't want those problems.
Well, I have a lot of respect for Jerry. I don't know. I mean, it's not a perfect comparison or anything like that. But let's just save that for off the camera, because oh my gosh.
And I will say also, speaking to Jerry and speaking of Frank, I think one of the things that also makes this show so great is every single character is incredible. Every single actor on this show who plays every single character, they hit a homer. I think the actress who plays Jerry is phenomenal. The way that she handles every scene, that she's always under control. She's always calculated in every move and every conversation she's having. She's incredible. I love Carrie, the Logan Roy's little side piece. And one of my favorite lines we always say to each other is, Marsha's in Milan shopping forever. I think she's, there's so many great lines. I mean, you know, me and Cece just text each other constantly with lines from this show about being disgusting brothers. We got to find somebody to add to Me, You, and Lope so we can have a quad squad. But I think the way they kind of hit on every single character and just the way they fit in this show and the way they kind of fit in this world, I think it's outstanding the way they've done it. Every one of these characters, I feel like if I see him on another show, I'd be like, oh, that's Carl. Or, oh, that's, you know what I mean? That's the sister from the MSNBC, the Pierce family. I just feel like every single character on this show fits so well in this world and understand how to play the characters in this world. And again, Jesse Armstrong has done a phenomenal job just building out this universe that we shouldn't be able to relate to, but we see all these characters and we are able to see the world through their eyes. And, you know, that's really the goal of any show, right?
And cooking tips, too. You can't make a tomlet without cracking a few Greggs.
That's right. That's right. If it is to be said, so it be. I've learned from this show how to, you know, testify before Congress. I've learned if you're building a panic room, you shouldn't have a small window that an attack child can fit through. You learn all type of lessons from watching this show.
Yeah, I mean, Tom being such a bad public speaker is so funny to me. Like, he's pretty eloquent and funny behind the scenes when he's just person to person, but when he gets in front of a group, oh my gosh, it's just a disaster every time.
Yeah, and I think, you know, something that we've talked about as well is this show balances, you know, how to have those hilarious moments between Tom and Greg, and also have those moments where it's like where Connor says, hey, when your family doesn't love you, you learn how to live without it, right? And those the scene where Tom and Shiv are on a beach and he's like, the sad I am with you without you is a little less sad than I would be with you, right? And they have these moments where the writing is just so great and it's just so earnest, and you're able to see these people it's not like just a pure comedy where like Seinfeld, where all of these people are just a farce and you just laugh at them and they're not real people. They're able to have these comic moments, but also show you that they're real people and they're dealing with real emotions and they're learning how to kind of live and thrive through this chaos that they're constantly living in. And it's like, yeah, a lot of this chaos is self-created, but it's also like, I'm trying to be a real person. If you're Connor, I'm trying to just develop a relationship that means something. And even if it means I've got to find this woman from the nightlife who just wants to create a screenplay, if I can just give her that just to have a real person in my life, I'm willing to do it. And I think so much of that stuff is just so well done on this series. And yeah, I can't wait to send my ballot in for Connor Roy 2024. That's my president. I'm a con head through and through.
Yeah, I believe Sands was Willa's production that I don't think ran on Broadway for very long.
Yeah, but were you one of the people who gave her a negative review on the iPad that she threw into the ocean?
Or? I for sure was, man. You know how much of a hater I am.
But no, I wish people could just see how often I just send CC random quotes from Greg and just constantly just bugging him, just all the, because he got on the show before me, so I was late to the show. So I believe you started watching from the very beginning, right?
My wife watched the first season and she was like, you need to be watching the show. And then I binged the first season. We picked it up, started season two, and I've been watching every week when it comes out since.
Yeah, so I jumped in after season three, before season four came out. So I kind of binged through the first three seasons in preparation for season four. So as I'm getting through it, I'm just constantly, I think easily this is the most quotable show of all time. Probably this and maybe The Wire. Just the quotes are just nonstop from this show. And obviously people, are we allowed to curse on here or no?
Sure, go for it.
Yeah, people love to do the, like, the fuck off and all of that stuff. But like, I think a lot of these, they're just so smart in all of the quotes. Let me say, I wrote some of them down, some of my favorites. She's a firecracker. She's a crunchy peanut butter, man. I love lines like that. No show is able to just throw stuff like that at you like every other scene, like I said, while also being able to give you a scene like Tom and Shiv on the balcony kind of just throwing haymakers at each other and just kind of doing everything they can to destroy each other emotionally. Just the way they balance that is unlike anything I've ever seen.
Roman talking about his sister and his brother-in-law, the country mouse and the hot tamale.
God, and that's the funny thing is, like, I feel like we haven't even talked about Roman, and he's like a classic what you think of when you talk about Succession. His lines and the way he's able to kind of sum up what you would think of like a shithead kid for a billionaire, he kind of embodies that, you know, maybe even more than Kendall.
A true sicko. I mean, an all-time sicko.
So this is the conversation that everybody has around this show. It's coming to an end, only a few episodes left. If there were to be a spinoff, what kind of spinoff are you looking for? Are we going politics with the Nazi that Roman's supporting? I guess, what are you thinking of the spinoff that you would love to see?
Oh, man. Well, assuming that Tom and Shiv do end up busting up, I mean, I think the obvious answer is a spinoff with just Tom and Greg and them at a different company. And yeah, man, just kind of more of like a straight comedy.
God, I would love a Disgusting Brothers show. Just give me that. I would just feed that directly into my veins. I need a Disgusting Brothers show. But I would love, I would think, I don't say this is a criticism maybe, but I think one of the things I'm surprised by when I watch this show, when you talk about these people who make so much money, have so much power, it feels like politics will be much more involved because people with that much money and that much power, they put their fingerprints all over politics and political figures, which is something we see in real life all the time. And I feel like a show where we're more focused on these political figures and how this money impacts politics and political decisions, I think will be very interesting. And like the Jared Mankin character of Roman, and, you know, if he becomes president, or if, you know, these last few episodes, Connor Roy weasels his way into ambassadorship in Oman, the rich man's Saudi Arabia, or the poor man's Yemen, depending on your perspective. it just I think that would be super fascinating as well. But yeah, I need Tom and Greg wherever we go in this universe. If they continue to bring it on beyond this show, I need just more Tom and Greg scenes. That's the show at its peak, is when Tom and Greg are just messing with each other and just saying just the stupidest stuff you can think of.
Oman, I better go ask my woman. Alan Ruck is really good too. Yeah, the writing is incredible. The performances are incredible. Like, it's actually art that kind of mirrors just how crazy America is today. I mean, it really is. Like, it's out there for any show with me.
Yeah, and it encapsulates so well that you don't have to be really smart or really ambitious or really good at any particular field to be really rich and really powerful. A lot of these people are just dumbasses who just got put in the right place at the right time. And you know, the people around them cover up all of the dumb stuff they do and say. But I think that this show kind of, you know, pulls the cover off. Yeah, a lot of these people are just dumbasses who got put in the right spot, and it's constantly people around them trying to put out the fires that they start. And of course, I'm not speaking about Connor, because that's our future president, so I would never say such a thing about him like that.
I could do Succession quotes with you literally all afternoon, but I don't think that's the best use of our time. Will is Pelicans beat writer for The Athletic. You can find his stuff at The Athletic. And what are you on Twitter? At Will Guillory?
At Will Guillory. And apparently I'll be at the Miami Championship Parade in a few weeks. So if y'all want to come to South Beach and holler at me, I'll see if I can sneak my way onto a boat. We'll be cruising down to Biscayne Bay, me and Jimmy and Kevin Love celebrating another championship in Miami. It seems like that's the way we're headed right now.
I've heard you're renting an apartment in Miami now. That's how much time you're spending there.
Yeah, I just need a few more button-up shirts so I can, you know, let the taco meat fly in the Miami sun. I'm not used to it here in New Orleans, but I'm adjusting. You know, I'm still getting there.
Well, you can handle the heat, you know? I mean, a lot of people, like the Miami heat, like the actual heat it's a lot for people from the East and the Northeast, especially, I've heard.
Yeah, it seems like you just can't make shots anymore if you stand out in the Miami sun for 10 minutes. So who knew?
All right, well, thanks for doing this, man. I really appreciate you. And thanks for listening, guys. Talk to you again soon.